Ray, I'm going to record this part in case I screw this up. This will be on the video, too.
At this point, I want to introduce Cliff and bring him up and share his experience, strength, and hope with us. Cliff R., President.
Hi, I'm Cliff Roach, and I'm an alcoholic. Spelled R-O-C-H-E. My phone number, Dr. Bob said, it's just as big a violation of traditions to keep yourself secret in meetings than it is to blow it at a public level. This is at the level of press, radio, and films. And we've added television. I wasn't anonymous when I was drinking. My wife has a story. I have no recollection. Most of my life is hearsay. I did? Oh, I'm sorry. My wife has a story where she, I was out all night. She knew where I was, and she looked out the front window, and I was lying naked in the front yard. And the paper boys were around me. And being a great member of Al-Anon, she went out and told the paper boys I was practicing a new form of meditation. All I could ask is, which side was up? And they know how to hurt you, don't they? She said, I don't remember. And you know, all this anonymity, I've never seen a pack load of reporters hanging around one of our conventions. You know, with their pens ready to write. They don't know we're alive, for God's sake. I want to tell a little anecdote before I get into my dreary story. When I was sober 8 months, I had really been trying this program. I've been a slipper for years, but I was giving it everything I got. I did a kind of a half-ass fourth and fifth step, and my sponsor had me to a meeting every night. But down in here, I couldn't get it. And I didn't know what it was. And when I was 8 months sober, get control of yourself, recover. My sponsor said we were going to go to a roundup. Giddy up. You know? I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. So he and his wife took Pat and myself to this roundup, and I had two spiritual experiences. There was a guy in our area who always said, I'm Charlie and I'm a grateful alcoholic. And it just pissed me off. I had nothing to be grateful for. I was used to think, if I break your nose, will you still be grateful? He just made me crazy. But I went to an Al-Anon little panel, you know, off in the corner where the Al-Anons are. And a lady named Grace. They each talked for like 15 minutes, and this lady named Grace had been in Al-Anon 12 years. And her husband had never quit drinking. And he was the kind of drunk I was. He was violent and miserable and cruel. And she said over and over, she was grateful for Al-Anon. And I thought, you jerk. All you've got, and she's still in it, and she's grateful. And that night, I went to the meeting, and a friend of mine from high school, I was sitting up in the back where I usually did, and he grabbed me by the neck, took me down to the front, and said, you know, sit up front with the winners. Of course, if you're the winner tonight, I look like John the Baptist, huh? Yeah, I was sitting there last night. Poor Bob, he lost his head. But the speaker that night was Tom Iverson. Tom I. And I don't know what happened. I don't remember a hell of a lot of what he said. But I knew I wanted what he had. And so I really worked the program. I started with one and I ended at 12, which is the program. And my life changed. And it's really been funny the last few years. I've been to 15 different conferences where Tom was there. I got to know him. And he let me get off my knees about 3 years ago. So if you miss tomorrow morning, you're going to miss it, pal. So anyway, the history of my drinking is pretty easy. I can sum it up with the first two times I drank. First time I drank, I was 16 years old, and I was in high school, and I was about 5'9", or about 5'2", and weighed 89 pounds. 12 pounds of that was pimples. I go to these high school dances, and there were only about two girls in the school I could dance with that were little enough, you know. But this other little weenie and I, we got behind the barn out there, and we had a half a pint of hot booze. And I got my half of the half pint down, and I was raised in an alcoholic family. Oh, really? Yeah. It was an Irish Catholic family. Say it isn't so. They were loving, good people, but alcoholism just had them, and it makes for a lousy childhood, doesn't it? It really makes for a lousy childhood. My mother died on Skid Row in Los Angeles just when she was 43 years old. So I didn't want to be like them. But I don't know. I took that drink that night. I drank that half of a half pint. And I went to that high school dance, baby. I danced with all of them. Hey, come on, baby, let's go. I didn't care where my face was. That's so let's dance. Oh, and I did a lot of that bumping that night. Were you macho drinkers, you remember? Hey, watch where you're going. I bruised several guys' knees, you know. And that was my introduction. And I thought, now I know why my folks drink, for God's sake. Why did I wait till I was 16? The second time I drank, we were out at a thing on Kern River near Bakersfield, where I was raised, and kind of a barbecue thing. And I drank a fifth of port wine all by myself. Because I figured it was that good with a half of a half a pint, a fifth would really get it. And it did. And I woke up the next morning in the Kern County Jail. Not a juvenile facility, the tank in Kern County Jail. I was beaten beyond recognition. Some of my people filled me in later, you know. I'd try to whip every guy there, and they'd all beat hell out of me. I tried a couple of smaller girls, same result. Later at night, I tried a deputy sheriff. And you know how that works. So I'm just beaten beyond recognition. Somebody had puked on my chest. I never caught him. Search for that guy. And they were rattling the bars to get us up. And you talk about terror. I'm 16 years old. I'm beaten to a pulp. I'm sick. And I'll never forget what I said. I said, I'll never do that again. And I never did. I never drank port wine again. To this day, I have not drank port wine. So that's kind of my drunk-along, you know. Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of times, I had a good time drinking. After the age of 16, I don't think I ever had a really good time where booze wasn't involved. I mean, maybe it was only three beers at a ball game, but booze was part of my life's existence, and that's what meant fun. I used to talk about fun. You know, I'd get beat to a pulp and go to jail. Fun. Finding your car at the bottom of a ravine in the morning with you in it. Fun. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place where they know what you're talking about when you say fun. Al-Anons have fun. But we have fun. They just don't understand us. But then, other times in my drinking, I would get to a certain point, and my brain would say, "Cliff, don't drink this one. Because if you do, you're going to do those tricks." So I always said, well, you know. And then I would drink the subsequent drinks, and I would go crazy. I was a madman. I would just did things that were embarrassing and humiliating and vicious and violent and cruel. Never remembered a thing. It was always blood, mine. I'm a good bleeder. You know, that's my defense. And I fought that. I didn't want to have blackout. I never had a good blackout, did you? I've looked for years to find somebody and say, "Oh, I had a delightful blackout." Yes. Not one. And I met Pat in college right after I'd won World War II. And she was just this little doll. She was going... She met me about 2 months before I met her. She was going out with my roommate, dating, and they went to this party, and they saw this madman in the kitchen taking the glasses out and smashing them against the refrigerator. Somebody else's house. Crash. And she said, "What the hell's the matter with him?" And Earl said, "Well, he always does that when he drinks." And she said, "He needs help." The Al-Anon four-letter word. He needs help. And so later on, I had an evening here, and I fell in love with her, and we got married. We've been married 62 years. She said the other day, "That's about long enough." That's the way I drank, and I became a school teacher, a high school teacher, and that makes you nervous, you know, when you're the kind of drunk I am. You know, I commit felonies when I'm unconscious. Real felonies. And so they take your license away when you do that, for your teaching license. So I just became paranoid about blackouts. The first 3 years I taught was in a little town called Manteca in the San Joaquin Valley. And people who live there never have to go to purgatory. They've been through it. And then after 3 years, we moved to Oceanside, where we live now, and where I'm going to die. And I was a real good teacher. That's the only bragging you'll hear from me tonight. I was a really good teacher. I liked the kids. Kids like me. Had a lot of fun. Very successful, if that's not an oxymoron for the teacher. But the drinking, that paranoia about blackouts, I solved that problem by drinking every day. Does that make sense to you? You're an alcoholic. And so every day I had to calm myself down with alcohol. I didn't have to be drunk, but I had to have booze every day. Now, occasionally I'd have one of those famous blackouts and I'd suffer through it, But when I moved to Oceanside, being macho, I became a surfer dude. And I loved surfing. I loved surfing. Aside from drinking, it's the greatest thing that ever happened to anybody. I surfed until I was 74 years old. You should have seen me that last couple of years. The kids love it. They say, "Help Mr. Roach back on his board. There you go." And a friend of mine, another surfer dude, he got the idea of opening this surf shop down at the beach. And he is a drinker, too. And so we opened a surfboard shop right on the ocean. This little room, it's all beat up, and we painted it and put windows in and got a refrigerator. And a few months later, we got some surfboards, too. No big rush there. We had these two chaise lounge chairs, and we sat there right on the ocean front every day and watched the sunset. Oh, nothing like watching sunset when you're bombed, huh? Somebody come and say, I'd like to rent a board. Screw off, Charlie, we're watching a sunset. But my drinking was getting me in a lot of trouble. It certainly ticked her off. And one Sunday I went down to fix a board. The shop was closed. It was in the winter. Nobody was around. And I was by myself there in the shop. And I'm sanding this board and getting the resin ready. And I was really thirsty. I had a hangover. Oh, really? On Sunday morning? Yeah, really. And I opened the refrigerator to see if there was something to drink in there. Coke or something. And Woody, my partner, had been there the night before, and he left about this much vodka in a half pint bottle. And there was some orange juice in the refrigerator. And I thought, that'll put the fire out. I was not a morning drinker, and I drank this little bitty drink, went on about, sanding the surfboard. And after about 20 minutes, my mind talked to me. Does your mind talk to you still? But I don't listen anymore. I don't pay attention to him. My mind said, shame on you. That was Woody's booze you drank. Why don't you go up to the liquor store and get good old Woody a pint? The kind of guy I am. That afternoon I got Woody a fifth. And I ended up crawling home on my hands and knees, 11 blocks. Fell into bed, got up in the morning and puked and puked and puked and puked. We used to talk a lot about puking, remember? Now we see throwing up. I puked. And I came out of the bathroom and my pre-Al-Anon was standing there with that expression, And I said to her, I got to do something about my drinking. I'm getting drunk when I don't even mean to. And she had cut this whole thing out of the paper, little darling. It was in the want ads, the little thing we always had. If you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to quit, call Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it. I think it's perfect, isn't it? We're not a treatment center. We're not a hospital. We're not a do-good society. Hell, we're not even very nice people. But we'll go to the ends of the earth for you if you want to quit. If you don't, that's the way I put it anyway. And so I called the office of Alcoholics Anonymous. They sent a guy named Stan out to get me, and he took me to meetings for like 3 or 4 days, and I realized that I had been hasty. I wasn't really that bad. And you did not impress me. You really didn't. I kind of thought of you as doo, 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 doo. I remember I was laying a little Nietzsche on him the third night, and this moron said, well, we keep it simple here. I said, no shit. You could have fooled me, Rudolph. So I resigned from AA. Have you ever done that? It really upsets them, doesn't it? Cliff, who? For the next 5 years, I was an AA loser. I would come into AA and I'd be here 30 days or 40 days, and I'd drink a year or two between, I sat in the last chair in the last row. If we had a speaker meeting, I sat back there and folded my arms and thought, oh, come on. And it kept getting worse. And these guys would tell me, hey, if you stay here, it'll be different. If you go back out, it's going to get worse. So I went back out and it got worse. And I got to tell you, though, I'm a functioning alcoholic. None of this Skid Row stuff for me. Bob. I call him the David Koresh of AA. The day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous this time, on the 13th of January, 1970, I weighed 158 pounds. I had like 3% body fat. I would surf for like 3 hours and then get out and run 5 miles. I could bench press 285. It took me 20 minutes to pass a mirror. My daughters used to get money from me when I didn't have a shirt on, which was most of the time. They say, "V up for me, Daddy, V up." And I'd say, "Oh, can I have $5? Yes." I was 2 years sober before I figured that out. And I was one of the top three debate coaches in the United States. Like being one of the top three prostitutes in Elko, Nevada. I became a top speech coach by mistake. The principal called me in one day. He did a lot of that. But he'd gotten this flyer about this debate and speech tournament, which was being held 30 miles down at San Diego State. He said, "Man, you know, you're teaching a speech class. Kids could help you." And I said, "Okay." So I got like four or five wanted to give it a go, and we went down the 30 miles. We got down to San Diego State. We found that these things are big deals. There were like 50 schools participating. Probably 500 contestants, all in beautiful suits and ties, wearing Levi's and sweatshirts. What the hell do we know? And they killed us. I don't know what kind of drunk you are, but I don't care for losing. And they ground us in our dirt, what they did. And I'm steamed anyway. I went in the coach's room. There's about 25 of them in there. And they've been doing this for years. They're all buddies. And they snubbed me all day. So I stayed there, you know, snubby longer. One guy there really ticked me off. He had this beautiful steel gray hair. Took like 8 barbers to get it right. Beautiful silver hair. And he had about a $5,000 suit on. The other coaches did this when they went in front of him. And about 2 p.m, he suddenly turns to me and says, "Where are you from?" I'm grateful to be spoken to finally, you know. I said, "Oceanside." And he said, "Oh, where's that?" 30 miles up the... He gave me a resentment. And for the next 4 or 5 years, I thought about him. And I built a speech team at Oceanside High. I built a juggernaut speech team at Oceanside High. I built a powerful team. And I did it with sheer hatred. Oh, you have any idea how much work that is? Make 150 people do what they don't want to do. 7 a.m. till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, I'm in their faces. And I'm screaming and I'm yelling, "I'm coaching!" A reporter one time asked my captain, "What's the secret of your coach's success?" The kid said, "Terror." She wasn't lying. But when you do that from 7 a.m. till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and don't eat all day, and drink 14 cups of coffee, and stay pissed off, you are wound up. I mean, the nerves hung out the end of my fingers that far. My brain was too big for my head. But out in the glove compartment on my 58 Chevy, my surfing car, one time I was drunk, I painted it with house paint. And half a pint of hot vodka. I love to talk about hot vodka at Al-Anon meetings. They go, but you and I know the elixir of the gods. And I don't drink it all day. See, I'm a functioning alcoholic. But when I get through here, it's there. And it would call to me all day. "Go get him, Cliff, baby. I'm waiting, darling." And I finished with the last hit. "Good night, Mr. Roach." "Yeah, that's right." And I lurked out to my 58 Chevy, and I get that hot vodka out. And I light a big stogie I smoked in those days, and I would drink half the half pint. Didn't you? Just... And I would puff on my cigar. damn, you're a good coach. And I finished a half a pint. Only car in the parking lot. 10 o'clock at night, completely empty faculty parking lot. Just the 58 Chevy and me having my social drinking. And then I would drive home and really get drunk. But while I was in that car, before I started home, I would have what I've always called my 8 minutes. And I think everybody alcoholic in this room knows what I mean. After I drink about a half an hour, something happens in me, and I have about 8 minutes where everything in my life is all right. I came this close to dying for that 8 minutes, because it's the only real peace of mind I'd ever had in my life. If you'd have stopped me on the street and said, "What's serenity?" I would have said about a quarter of a half a pint, a half pint. And so I would drink that vodka and all of us, and I'd drive home. And we had these five children. The oldest daughter was 17, and the youngest daughter was 7. There were five of them, and they were all loony. God knows she was crazy. No human power could have relieved my family. My daughter, the oldest daughter, she's in a sick relationship with some nitwit. And my young oldest son is working his way through high school as a hashish salesman. And never had to give him any spending money, I'll guarantee you. I said, "Hey, I'm up for a fifth once a week." "Yeah, Dad." "What do you do?" Of course, his head went like this all the time. Called his mother, "Man." "Hey, man, what's for dinner?" Oh, he was a pip. He loved LSD. And I'd be right in the middle of a sentence, and he'd say, "What was that?" Of course, the shape I'm in by then is, "I don't know, what was that?" And my drunken mother-in-law lived with us, and she said, "I'll explain it." We used to listen to the explanation. That would blow my mind. But I want to tell you that everybody in that house was insane. We were all crazy. And not only that, there was a lot of hatred. They hated me. There's no doubt about that. And they were terribly angry with her because she wouldn't do anything about me. You know? And they didn't like each other that much. And it was just a sick, horrible place. I made my mother and father look like saints. I was terrible. But I built that speech team. And after a couple of years, we won one of those tournaments. But I'd say things to the gray-haired guy, "We know when it's time, do we, huh? I think revenge is better than Christmas." The next year, there were like 12 or 14 tournaments. My team took first place in every single tournament. But I can wait. The next year there was a tournament. There were 25 schools competing in the tournament. And my team scored more sweepstakes points than the other 24 schools combined. Then I went up to the gray-haired guy. And I put my nose right against his and I said, "Do you know where Oceanside is now?" And he just looked blank. He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Don't you remember about 4 or 5 years ago? 4 or 5 years ago, you said to me, 'Oceanside, where's that?'" And he said, "We just moved here from Nebraska. I didn't know where it was." The story of a resentment. And they'll do it to me today just as well as they did then. But right after that, Pat and I had one of our main events, which the neighbors have come to miss so much. Our neighbors never got television until after I got sober. I don't know. Were we the only ones that were always the neighborhood show? "Hey, he's coming back. He's coming back." They all had those Venetian blind marks on their forehead, you know. But this night we had this beef, and I threatened again to move out, and they all said, hey, go for it. So I moved out, and I'm living down at the beach where I wanted to live anyway with my surfboard. I'm living with my buddy and his girlfriend, and I had said for years, if I could just unload that witch and those long-haired dope fiend children, I'd be okay. And I was rid of them, and it wasn't okay. And I was drinking all the time. I was missing work for it I had never done. My old man told me, if you eat breakfast, go to work, you're not an alcoholic. It made sense to me. He never said a word about puking breakfast back up. I felt like my life was slipping between my fingers. That's what it felt like. And I went by the house one afternoon to ring Pat, probably about money. And the hashy salesman was kind of bobbing there in the background, humming a tune from the planet Pluto. And the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life, I turned to my 16-year-old son and I said, Dave, what's it like not to have your old man around the house? And my 16-year-old boy with his big brown eyes looked me right in the eye and he said, it's beautiful. And that's my bottom. I didn't know it for several hours, but that's as far as I'm going. I'm sorry, Bob, no treatment centers, no prisons. That's the way it goes. Just a weenie bottom. And I went back to the house and I sat on the porch and watched the most beautiful sunset on the ocean I've ever seen. And about the time that the sun was going down into the water, I saw me. I saw what my son saw. You know, I had given up my own self-respect a long time before that. And I went in the bedroom and dug out this old sea bag that I had, stuff that I didn't use, and dug out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new or nearly new, I read it for 3 days and three nights. I called in sick. I didn't eat much. And I read the big book from cover to cover. I read all the stories. And in the second edition, there was a story called The Professor and the Paradox. He was another egotistical school teacher. And he saved my life. On the third night, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was on page 63 again. And it seemed like it would be a good idea if I'd kneel down on that filthy little wing floor and I would read that prayer out loud to myself, the third step prayer. All right, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And I sponsored lots and lots of guys in the program of Alcoholics, lots of them. And the number one defect of character of every man I've ever worked with is self-obsession. And God knows that's where I lived, in the state of self-obsession. And I started to go to AA in earnest. I knocked on the guy, Bill Blake's door. He's been dead now about 22 years. But every time I come to AA, he'd pounce on me. You know the type? Hi. Oh. He would say idiotic things to me like, you want to go to Los Angeles with us tomorrow night? No. What I wanted to say was, I can't stand you jerks here. Why would I want to drive 100 miles to see Samari? But isn't that funny? I had this terrible resentment against him. He lived around the corner from me. And I knocked on the door. And it's raining. It's cold. And I'm just standing there, beaten. And Margie, Bill's wife, opened the door. And if you're new, listen. I have never seen anyone so glad to see me in my life. This loser. She said, Cliff. Oh, Cliff. In the house I go. Pours me a cup of coffee. Oh, this is wonderful. Bill's had nobody to work with lately. This is so good. And then Bill comes in. Ah, Cliff. And a half an hour, I'm thinking, anything else I can do to help you folks out? Cliff's here, we can start AA now. And by the way, that was the last nice thing the man ever said to me to the day he died. Oh, he was vicious. First 5 years, the only thing he would say to me is, shut up. One day I said, well, I have degrees, you know. He says, so does a thermometer. You know, they stick that sometimes. And he took me to an AA meeting every night for 2 years. You want to talk about love? Huh? This guy took me to a meeting every night for 2 years. He had two reasons. That was the only way I could make it. And number two, my children had to have to see me every night. They were in bed when I got home. And Alan and I had gotten in our family and was starting to work. So it was good for me and it was good for them. They even started talking to me. Everywhere we went, he took me to meetings where people were having a good time. I don't know about you, but that's the only kind of AA I want, you know. I want to go where they're laughing. I'm sorry, great tunnel meetings don't do it for me. You ever hear Clancy talk about the great tunnel meetings? Where the six guys sit around the table and stay sober. And sobriety's like this long gray tunnel and you trudge. And every year a cake comes down. Isn't that it? Don't look for me there. I'm going where the laughter is. I think laughter is the spiritual part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new or nearly new, it is a spiritual program. Every bit of it. There's nothing but spiritual in this program. Not religious. Absolutely not. Now, if you want to be religious, that's fine. We don't care. But it's a spiritual program. And he taught it to me. That's the way he believed, and that's the way I believe too. Whatever was wrong in my life, he told me to do something for you. Does that make sense? You know, I'd come over from my house, bang on the door, and he'd say, oh, come on in, Cliff. I'd say, you know what they're doing over there now? And I'd scream and yell and curse and tell him all my troubles, and I'd end up sobbing. He never interrupted me, you know. You know how they listen? I've always found it's good to make a little noise once in a while, like, huh? Then they think you're paying attention. They think you're paying attention then, you know. Well, I would finish with these massive problems. And he would say, go get Al and take him to the meeting. We're having a nervous breakdown here. What the hell is that? But I was afraid of him, so I'd go get Al, who I despised. He'd been slipping 10 years. I only slipped 5. And he had no driver's license, of course. And he was the biggest blowhard the world has ever known. And I would drive Al to the meeting. Blah, 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 blah. We'd go in the meeting, set up the meeting, and the meeting came. Everybody went home. We set the meeting down. Al was so shaky, he had to wash the cups. He'd put his hands in the water, you know, shaky. But I could drive. And I'd load Al in the car and drive him home. Blah, blah, blah. And I'd start driving. I'd let Al off and I'd start driving home. And this feeling would come over me. It scared the hell out of me. It felt so good. It just frightened me. You know, it started like right here. And it spread. It would last 40 seconds, maybe. But I want to tell you, it felt better than the 8 minutes ever was. It felt better than the 8 minutes ever was. And so, I've been trying to do for you for, what, 42 years now plus? And it grows on you. It really does, doesn't it? You get used to caring about other people. You know, all my life I knew what was wrong with me. I've always known. I've known since I was 4 years old. I have never been loved enough. It's true. And my sponsor recognized that, but my sponsor recognized what my real problem was, and he never told me. He never once mentioned it. He knew my real problem was I had never loved enough. I didn't know how to start to begin to learn how to love. So what he did, he made me take loving actions. for you that made no sense whatsoever. I mopped your coffee up if you spilled it. The thing I hated the most was be at the door and greet people, because I'm a snob. How are you tonight? Like I really... greet at the door, clean up the meeting, do the cups, and nothing that made any sense, but it grows on you. And the most important thing he did, we got a lot of 12-step calls in 1970. And he took me on every 12-step call he went on. Now, I didn't do anything. I just stand there and be a good example. But I saw the miracle happen over and over and over again. And I picked up this habit when I go on a 12-step call. The first thing I do, it's for me. I get down and I look in the guy's eyes. You know what I see? I see my eyes 42 years ago. I hope I never see that look in my eyes again. And hundreds of times I've taken a guy, take him to a meeting, one meeting, go to a coffee shop after a meeting, look across the table, and the power's in his eyes. One meeting, one night. I see what happened. I gave a guy a 39-year cake the other night. And I got to see the light come on in his eyes. And if you don't believe in a higher power, I suggest you do that. I suggest you go on 12-step calls, BU, Al-Anon, or AA, and watch the miracle happen. And if you don't believe me, then watch somebody that comes in and then go back out after a while. Then go look in their eyes. And you'll see what I'm talking about. So it just became a habit. Doing for you. Mother Teresa was in our area a long time before she died. Of course she was before she died. She had a heart attack and was in the hospital. And a buddy of mine was a cardiologist taking care of her. He said, Cliff, you cannot be in a room with that woman and know she's a spiritual giant. You just feel it. And about that time, this reporter had asked her a question, and her answer was in the paper. So I cut that out and carried it with me till it turned brown and yellow and rotted away. Because Mother Teresa answered the question like this. She says, the fruit of faith is love. And the fruit of love is service. And the fruit of service is peace. I will comprehend the word serenity, and I will know peace. Because the fruit of service is peace. And that's what my buddy was talking about last night. You have to give it away to keep it. And it's so much fun. Don't you love to make fun of newcomers? God, that's fun. Tell me again your problems. The great Jewish theologian Martin Buber said, there's only two emotions in the world. There's only two. There's love and there's fear. And then he said, they are mutually incompatible. I can't be in one if I'm in the other. It is impossible. And so you have taught me through the years to stay in love. I love everything about this program, everything about it. And I can't conceive of myself ever going away. My favorite show is Chorus Line. Oh, what a good show that is. In the show, the guy who has a voiceover kind of thing, there's this old bag dancing in the chorus, and she used to be a big star. And so this guy really gets on her and says, what are you doing? You're still up there hoofing. You know, your time has passed. You're in the chorus when you used to be somebody. What are you doing for? And she said, you don't get it, pal. I do this for love. Doesn't matter if I'm front or back. I'm doing it for love. And the last line of the song, the last two sentences, she says, she sings, but she says, So I won't forget, and I can't regret what I did for love. What I did for love.